That's when you're banging your head against the wall, right? But yeah. I think you got to stand on, you know, doing the right thing. And
just principles.
Ethics and principles. You know, hopefully that broker, if he brings another deal that has similar attributes that we just went through, you know, that he knows, like, you're the right type of buyer.
Real Estate Hustlers Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Appleman, founder and CEO of Appleman Capital. Today, we are joined with Ross MacArthur. Ross has more than 15 years in software, from startups to Fortune 500s. Ross turned his passion for real estate into success. Now, Ross manages over $40 million in holdings and runs a thriving investment group. Ross, we appreciate you coming on the show today. If you could, let the listeners know a little bit more about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Josh, and I appreciate you reaching out. Well, first and foremost, I got to give the name of the pod a little bit of credit, because I think anybody who is in real estate or entrepreneur like yourself, the attribute is usually hustler somewhere in that. So I'm glad it's named that. I couldn't think of a more fitting name for it. So, but yeah, as Josh said, my name is Ross MacArthur. I grew up and born and raised in Michigan. So Josh and I got to talk a little bit about Kentucky and Ohio a little bit earlier, but a lot of synergies there between us. And, you know, like most people, I had an aspiring, you know, I guess, career, corporate ladder is what I wanted to go after early, because that's all I knew. But throughout that, I was able to work actually for an entrepreneur who started a startup company, a software startup company. And so that really got me thinking, my mindset from W-2 to actually an entrepreneur. But ever since I was young, real estate just fascinated me. Like, I mean, I'm sure you're the same, Josh. Like, there's just somehow, some way, the people you meet who do it, it just, you're just like, wow, man, I want to be like that guy. And so I didn't have anybody around me. And so in a sales role, you have a lot of windshield time. And like most people, I picked up podcasts, books, anything I could to learn a lot about it. And I kept saying to myself, well, wow, these guys are doing it. Why can't I? And so finally, after lots of discussions with my wife, we decided to buy our first property. And like most people do, I started small. So I did a 4-unit property in Indiana. Yeah, it went pretty good. I always joke, like, we could buy a Chipotle burrito once a month off of it. You know, we weren't losing money, but we weren't making a bunch of money either. But that, to me and to the listeners out there, that was proof of concept. Like, oh, this actually kind of works. And so we decided, let's go ahead and be more active. So we picked up a couple duplexes that summer. This is all in January 2020 to essentially June 2020, right during that COVID time where half the people were jumping out and felt like half the people were going deeper than they've ever been in real estate in that time. And we were going deeper than we've ever been. So as we were doing that, we figured out the power of local lending. I'm sure you've done this yourself, Josh, but, you know, cash out refi. So we would buy a property right away. We had a company that would do immediate cash out refi. So day one. And so as long as we could buy it at a 25% discount, we were able to refi within a month and get our money back. That's where the light bulb really went off. And that's how we grew in our first year of business, essentially a 4-unit property to 125 units. You know, that went really well. But like most people, they realize at some point in time, like, it's a lot of work to do a 2 and a 4 unit property. How do I spend the same amount of work but go bigger? And that's when the light bulb went off for the second time and said, all right, well, let's go, I would say small to medium multifamily at 20 to 125 units. And me and my partner, Stan, we're going to do that together. It was not a group investing company, actually, in the beginning. It was just really for us. And being a long-term W-2 employee, and you know this, you surround yourself with a lot of high-wealth people, they want to do it, but they don't do it. And so we had a lot of people asking us questions. And finally, a neighbor said, well, why don't I just invest with you? And then that was the next big hurdle where we were like, okay, well, instead of just me and Stan doing it, why don't we take in a bunch of friends and family as investors? That brings us up to 2022, and we closed on our first group investing deal in September 2022, and since then, we've bought about 600 units. So our goal is, as we close out the year, to hopefully rinse and repeat going into 2024. So I know that's a little long-winded, and I skipped a bunch of stories in between, but hopefully that gives you guys a high-level introduction.
Yeah, no, that's great, because just giving away nuggets is what it's about, and telling people your journey, how you got there, and where you're at and where you're heading. The the partnership piece, there's things in real estate, the intangibles. The cash flow is great if it kicks off excess cash flow put in pocket, but you can also, it's sitting on your balance sheet, having that essentially real estate, you can buy more. It's compounding. The more you have, the more you can buy. It puts on your an asset on your balance sheet, leverage against it if you need to, and then in order to buy more as well, plus your depreciation. So just, it might be buying a, like you said, a Chipotle burrito, but at the same time, you're adding those intangibles to your balance sheet, and it's there to grow off of. Tell us the partnership piece. So you're are you all joint venturing? Are you syndicating? What kind of structure are you after?
Well, I'll elaborate a little bit. And I'll go back. So in the very beginning, that first, you know, let's just call it 125 units, was just my wife and I, and the goal was to lower our retirement age. So everyone who's listening, I worked as a, you know, executive at a large software company all the way up until March of 2023. So that first 3.5 years, essentially, I was burning the candle at both ends, trying to build what I would call a larger retirement fund. And the original goal was I wanted to stop working at 55, and then it became 50, and then it became 45, and the age kept going as we would grow. And then we started a flipping company, and we do about 25 flips a year. That business is just my wife and I still. So that's kind of our business. And then Stan and I created a, I don't like to use the word syndication because that usually means, depending on who's listening, everybody and anybody. So there's a segment of syndication that you've probably elaborated before that's kind of friends and family, joint venture. So we focus on that. And so Follow the Deal Investments is really that first rim of friends and family, or maybe a referral from that. And so those 600 units that we've added over the last 15 months is through that type of partnership.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because like, if we bring people in on our deals, we're the operator. We're not just someone raising capital to then invest into someone else's deal. We're actively operating and involved in the asset on a day-to-day basis. Are you all utilizing third-party property management?
That's another, there's a lot of stories in here, but we did up until a certain point. So we were very fortunate. A partner and a friend of ours named James, who's invested with us in the past, he has about 5 or 6 different startup businesses that he's done, kind of serial entrepreneur like yourself. And so he had a lot of management companies. So he has a lifeguard management company that works with Disney and the cruise lines as an example. And so when we were starting to scale and we got to about 500 units, we were having a lot of issues with third party. It was grateful for them, and they got us to a certain point, but to take the next big step, we needed something better. And so James volunteered to spearhead and launch our property management company that we recently just partnered on and bought into. We're going on about 4 months operating now. And so to anybody listening, like, third-party management can be great. It definitely helps you get to a certain point. But I think once you hit a certain level, instead of paying property managers $1 million a year to manage your properties, that becomes not only a way to get better service by starting your own, but also becomes an income stream long term for yourself.
Yeah, 100%. And communication is everything. Being able to execute on a business plan, especially on a value add purchase, it's even more important. Knowing exactly the next 5 moves, you have to communicate that with the PM, and then hopefully they do their end. So it's when you bring everything in-house, you're fully vertically integrated with the renovations, property management, and the business plan in full sync. It's you're able to poke as hard as you need to poke to get things done. But there are third-party property management companies, I think, when you get to a certain size or maybe a scale to where they can be leveraged in a different capacity, in different asset classes as well. But I think there's a give and take on both ends.
One thing we found was, and I'm sure you've seen this, but in property management companies, depending on, you know, the type and all the things that you just said, I think are really important to take evaluation of. But one of the things that we found was every ownership group is different, right? And so if they work with 50, 100, 1,000, you name the number, different owners, that's essentially different standard operating procedures for each one. you're going to want reports differently and more frequently or less frequently than I want them. You want communication styles differently. You want renovations differently. So there's all these different standard operating procedures. What's really nice about when you have a dedicated property management company that's 100% focused on you is there's one standard operating procedure. And so how much more efficient does your people, when it comes to working with you, the efficiency goes through the roof because there's one way to do it, not 15 different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're able to do to blend expenses. And I say that you're not in business to be a property management company. You're in business to make sure that the asset performs to the highest of its capacity. So you're not relying on fees to keep your bills paid and then the investment keeping its bills paid. It's everything can be blended in different capacities. So it's your returns are what they should be and your property's performance and on and on and on. There's a ton of upsides, but at the same time, you're possibly limiting your own growth by being, I'm not going to say stuck in the weeds, but your attention has to go into different areas where otherwise you wouldn't be. But I think that's most important because now you're able to focus on the performance of the property as well. And once you put the right people in front of you, then that's where you can scale. Tell me about your old property management company. That's interesting.
So yeah, we use a hub and spoke model because one of the things I found with, man, there was two different types of property management companies out there. Ones that were incredibly overinflated on employees, people, and others that just didn't, they had a smaller team, but they weren't the right people. And so we found like that we needed to blend that. And so we use a hub and spoke model. So what I mean by that is we have a office where essentially our director of VP operations is out of. And then we have a leasing associate, and their job is tenant communication and obviously leasing, right? Along with some other minor maintenance and things like that. And then the hubs are actual PMs. So they're a property manager that covers a region or an area. And so we have 700 units, and we have and the CFO, by the way. So CFO for the financial side of it. So with six employees, we're covering 700 units. And it's because we picked, you know, to your point, and I would never start a property management company or have that idea unless I had the right people, because that would be a nightmare, to your point earlier. But we have six people covering 700 units. And I think we can get to about 850 before we need to add on more other people. And it's, guess what? It's almost twice as efficient than it was before. And so, I want to reiterate this point to the person who has 10 units listening right now or 20 units, don't do it. Like, that sounds awful. Like, you're not to the point where you can, but there becomes a point where there's a fork in the road for every operator. And again, use the word operator earlier. So we're operators, not, you know, raising funds, for every operator where they have to decide, do I want to go property management or do I want to rely on third party or do I want a blended approach? And so for us, you know, it made a lot of sense, but if you have 10 or 20 or even 100 units, it probably doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it wouldn't kick off enough excess cash flow to even pay for property management. I think that's a learning opportunity to get in there and learn the industry and get the property management where you want it to be at, and then get to scale, get the amount of units that you need in order to cash flow positive. But you're right. We've been using Buildium for probably 4 years now. We're now switching over to AppFolio, which has much more robust reporting. You get to certain levels and then it's time to change out. You don't like it. There's never a good time to do it. But in order to get to the next level, you've got to scale up all systems to reach the next capacity level.
We haven't found anybody. I've used Buildium before. We interviewed Buildium through our process. A third party used them, and it was decently effective from our, you know, as a owner using a third party. And then most of our other companies that we use for third parties were on AppFolio. So we interviewed those and a few other vendors, as I'm sure you guys did. And what we to kind of to your point, like AppFolio still seems to be the best to date. Now I wish there was something that took it to the next level, and hopefully somebody, either they continue to grow or some other software steps up and really grows in that arena. But yeah, we use AppFolio as well.
Well, it's the parent sister levels of accounting that you can do, the different levels of LLCs, that capacity is where Abilidium just doesn't have that functionality. And you get to a point where you've got to have it in order to produce reports. And I'm sure just like you all, as far as financials, send out your financial packages once a month, property performance, bank accounts, all that good stuff to your partners.
Yep, exactly. So we, our CFO, which was by far the best hire we ever did, by the way. So she's a CFO for not only the property management company, but also follow the deal investments. So great synergy, right? Because she's managing the left and the right. But yeah, she packages everything together usually by the 10th of the month, 8th of the month when things are finalized. Sends us, we review those on Friday, the Friday after, and then we send out a once a month recap to all our investors with the financials, highlights, renovations, and that is all done through, and I'm not sure if you guys use the investor portal, but I always like in podcasts when people mention software, so we use InvestNext for it. Yep. I'm sure there's better ones or weaker ones, but they seem to check a lot of boxes, and it's been good for us so far, so we use the InvestNext portal to send that information out.
Yep, same here. It's been we were with, I think it was Syndication Pro, and then we went over to InvestNext. Just capabilities and functionalities turned, I think it's more user-friendly, but no, definitely we're on the same page. So getting back to your real estate, what are some key lessons that you've learned along your entire journey, some lessons that that you can now take with you forever? Because everything's a learning lesson.
So, you talk a lot, and so I'm going to try to use some that I say often, and I'm going to try to use some lessons that maybe I haven't talked about before. So one of the ones is, again, you're an entrepreneur with multiple businesses in your past and currently, right? So there's home runs in businesses, and sometimes they're not, right? Let's just be honest. There's businesses that start every day that fail. And very early on, I started dabbling in wholesale, mostly for myself. Right. So wholesaling is I want to go get a property under contract, direct to seller, usually smaller properties, small multifamily or single family. And either I was going to buy it or I was going to sell that contract to somebody else and make the profit in between the purchase price and what I had it under contract for. And so one of the things I did, right, that very first company is I went and did all the branding. I did the branding. I did the Facebook page. I did a LinkedIn page. Created separate emails. I mean, I did all this work for a concept. Yeah. And what I realized later is separate phone numbers is that I actually didn't need any of that to start that type of business. And so I spent hours and time and energy that I could have spent creating what I used earlier, proof of concept, like with my wife. And don't get me wrong, the business was semi-successful and eventually we just stopped doing it and got bigger to other things. But, you know, I think one of the lessons I've learned over the years is, you know, a lot of times you just need to start a business and you've got to get to a proof of concept before you do the 900 other things that go with a business. The other thing that kind of goes along with it is you have to find ways to simplify business. At the end of the day, real estate, creating software, any insurance companies, it doesn't matter. Name the business. They're all kind of the same. They really are. And the core concepts are the same, but we love to overcomplicate things. And then when we overcomplicate things, we do nothing, right? You absolutely stall and you do nothing. In real estate, how many people, Josh, have you talked to in your friend circle that say they want to do real estate and they'll keep saying it until one day you guys are 55 years old and they're still telling you that they wish they did real estate?
Yeah.
Right? It's really overcomplicated, right? So those are two big concepts, I think, that... You know, one, when you're building something, get to a proof of concept first and avoid overcomplicating, because I did it early on and I think most people do.
Yeah, that's a huge point, because you want everything to be bright and shiny and perfect, and then there's really no problem to even solve. So it's like create the problem and then you create the solution. That's what we say around morning meetings, what's the new problem we're going after? Because if you're creating motion, creating new problems, you got to hire a new person, you've got to put in a new workflow, it's growth. Growth comes with new problems to solve, and that equals scalability too. I went down in the weeds myself, creating the email addresses, the URLs, making sure we secure this, secure that, and there's no problem to even solve. You don't.
Yeah, you have no revenue, right? There's zero revenue.
Right, right.
The other thing I think to go along with this, and I'm sure you've done this because I know I have. Unfortunately, I did avoid this mistake, but it was one that I was tempted to make, and I see most people make is that, you know, we want to like hire people and have a team. I think it's just like our herd mentality. Like I think we just want people to do this with. And to be honest with you, that's the wrong thing to do 99% of the time, in my opinion, is go bootstrap a business, whatever it might be. I don't care what entrepreneurship avenue you go, because people are in all different types of things. We're in real estate, right? So go bootstrap whatever you're going to do. Again, proof of concept, and then figure out where you really need people, right? You don't even know. You only have a business yet, and you're going to go hire somebody or potentially partner with somebody. Go figure out the business first. Do it for a year or two or three or four, however many, and then figure out the gaps that you need and hire somebody or bring a partner on. You know, I think people look to add human beings to our processes day one, where they really need to kind of see how the business works.
That's huge. That's a great point, because people, when you're creating something new, you're creating something new. So if you don't know what that looks like, because you haven't been there, done it, and you're going to put somebody in front of you to do it for you, to extract that out of your head, it never works out. I've been there, and it's just, it does, but everything that we have compounded down on and focused on and thought and made, looked all the way through to the end, it's worked. And you put people in those scenarios after you've already figured out the flow, and it works out. But trying to put somebody in front of you to figure it out for you, it doesn't, it never, in my opinion, is, well, it hasn't ended well for me. Just usually it just gets shelved. But yeah, no, I totally agree. So let's talk about the market, the debt markets, capital markets, what you're seeing out there, and then how you all foresee the 2024 and beyond.
Yeah. So, I mean, we entered buying real estate in January 2020, where, you know, interest rates were, you know, sometimes even sub 4. I think our first deal we ever did was 3.99, right? So, you know, we've seen, and there was never agencies, which agency would have been lower than that, right? So, yeah. You know, for us, we started at the best time debt wise, and we've in the last 15 months have seen it go from really good debt to the worst debt in years. But one of the things I like to talk about in this is that, you know, we've continued to stay active, and, or as I like to call it, you know, around the hoop, you know, because there are deals that work, but the debt scenario has changed so much. And so it just has caused everyone to be pickier. Like, we've done 15 deals in about 15 months. You guys just closed on some stuff you told me before the show. So we're both still being active. And I think what's kind of caused it, a mind shift, is you have to push to make sure that you're not stretching on deals now more than you ever have. Before, sometimes you take a little bit of a calculated gamble. Now you're like, hey, listen, my conservative model, I'm not fluffing those numbers at all. So debt recently for us, we use a lot of local banks, commercial lenders, things like that, credit unions today. We've never done agencies, so full transparency, we haven't gone that route yet. And we, you know, we just got quoted and closing on a small deal on Friday, 7.1.
Okay.
You know, and there is debt less than that. You know, I think we're going to be able to get in the sixes here. But what we found recently is, yes, the debt is, the 10-year started to go down a little bit, actually a decent amount in the last couple of weeks. But banks on the 5-year and on the 10-year aren't completely following that swing yet. And because they're being cautious, because they're worried that it's going to go like this again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, debt is still very high. But I'm a true believer, if you can make a deal conservatively work, even if it's not a home run, it's a single or a double, when interest rates do eventually come down, you know, you're going to be in a really good spot. So that's kind of our belief. That's what we're seeing. We are starting to see seller expectations start to dwindle. Barely. I mean, like, we're scratching the surface here, but we are slowly starting to see that, because about 6 months ago, when rates first started jumping, I don't know about you, Josh, but we weren't seeing sellers come off it at all.
I think that the sellers that don't need to sell, I think the mentality is going to stay somewhat the same. But the sellers, I think it's the sellers that are going to have to sell is where the deals are going to present themselves. And I mean that by the rising interest rates that have bridge debt on them, and those rates keep rising, and they have no out. They can't refinance. They can't, so they can't get any locked in interest rate debt. They just got to get out. It's hemorrhaging their cash position, and it's either that or face a foreclosure. I think those are the opportunities. But the guys that don't need to sell, the groups that don't need to sell, they're financed right. They're locked in. There's no sense in them really taking a discount because they know that we're in a cycle.
So question for you though, because we were talking about this again early on, and I'm kind of curious your take on this is, you know, because real estate got so hot there, that means the cost basis continued to go like this, right? You know, and so some people bought at such a high cost basis. Do you think though, how are those deals going to pan out? You know, those people who bought at 20% more than they're really worth, and now their debt's coming due and they're really back against the wall. What do you think is going to happen to those people?
Yeah, those are the opportunities that I think are going to present themselves. So the groups that bought based on performa, based on the broker saying the property down the road is producing X on rental rates, and that's why this property is worth this. Those are the sub four cap by the things that were negative cash flow out of the gates. You have to bump up the rents even to get into positive territory, and even to hit a five mark. Those are the ones that are going to be presenting themselves, and already are in a. And I think that we're going to see even more of those in Q1 and the end of Q1. I'd say it's going to be full-fledged by Q2 of next year. And then Q3 is going to – we've got election year too. We've got and we haven't even seen the Black Swan event. What is that going to be like?
It's not uncharted territory, but it is. Like, you know, the last big – dip we saw was because we were lending a broom $1 million, right? You know, like literally you'd have a pulse and you'd be able to get a $500,000 loan. So we're in different times where that's not the problem. There's other problems, right? And so, hey, listen, we're going to continue to be active. I suggest people to be active, you know, just don't stretch, you know, and be ready for if a deal does come that you can take it down. And if a deal presents it today, it's a single and a double, and it still leaves you pretty liquid, take it down.
Yeah. Yeah. We're certainly right now pumping out the content to gain JV and LP partners on, to just seize the opportunity. It's buying the dip. And for good reason. I mean, we've waited how long? Me and you have bought properties, bought properties conservatively, not getting wrapped up in the FOMO, fear of missing out, because all the other groups are buying. We bought to keep the properties, not to give them back. So now it's there's an opportunity to buy at the right basis, switch out the management, increase the value of the property through renovations, through just better management practices, put the right debt on it, and do it right. Buy right. I'd say you're buying a business in multifamily. It's an actual business. It has a P&L. So to buy a transacting business on a future value, I'm glad I didn't get wrapped up into that. It was tempting at times because
So let me ask you that, because I like to talk about MB and FOMO a lot. So how do you put your blinders on and avoid it, especially being a host of a podcast, especially with the content that you're particularly the guests that you have on? Like, let's be honest with you. Like, you know, every time I do a podcast, I listen to somebody else's who's a guest, and I'm like, wow, they killed that. Like, I want to be like that guy. Like, how are you in your growing business, having a podcast for the last year and a half, kind of tuning out the noise?
I'm incentivized by, of course, there's monetary being incentivized by the monetary. How much can this thing produce, and how much is it going to produce? So to me, is where my time is being spent. That it needs to be worth it. And on deals, it's a 3 to 5 year hold that you're married to that property. So if you're buying it, if the equity is already taken out on the buy, so say you should be buying it for $40,000, but instead you buy it for $60,000, and you still need to put $10,000 to $15,000 into each unit. There's no big play there after you get everything done, because the sellers have already taken all of the equity that you've deserved, that you've worked hard for. They've already taken that out because you bought it on a future value. And I think that the reason we haven't bought in on deals like that is just in our vibe. I couldn't get my head wrapped around it.
Yeah, me either.
It is a very tough and very delayed gratification model real estate, because you're going through, you're renovating the units. You have to go through an eviction practice because you simply have bad tenants. You have to release it. It's a huge process, and you're stuck in the armpit of the deal. So it's, as an operator, we're not syndicating and putting it in other people's deals. We are operating the property. So that's I think, is the part of being way more selective than what other groups were being selective on, because they're putting property management in front of them and then telling property management what they need to do for this property, versus the operator where our staff, we're deeply involved on it on an emotional standpoint too, on day to day. So I think that's the biggest piece of why we were able to not get wrapped up into the hype.
Yeah, I mean, that's super well put. I think it's the other thing is, when you talk about, use the 40-60 example, it's really worth 40, but the owner wants 60 because it could be worth 60 or it could be worth 65 or whatever. Isn't real estate the only business that where people want you to pay for the value you have to create? It's the only business out there. Like any other business, if you went and bought a franchise or you went and bought any startup company, like it's a certain multiple of revenue. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't understand why you have to pay for the benefit of doing all the work that may or may not work out. And so I have that conversation. I'm sure you do with brokers every day. Like, I'm not paying to do this guy's work.
That's an echo. Absolutely. Cause it's, you are 100% in sync, and it's, and on the broker's end, their duty and obligation to the seller is to get the highest, most possible price out there on the market. And if somebody out there is willing to pay the price, that's great. There's renegotiation tactics when you get it under contract and go through the motions. I have not been very good at that. But I think it comes to a certain point where you just got to play the game, and that's kind of an expectation out there too. We go in with the mindset of we'll figure out how much CapEx we need. We've got a trained eye. We've got trained people with us. We'll put it under contract for what we feel we can close at, and hopefully there's no surprises, which you factor those in. Other groups will put under contract and renegotiate at the 11th hour and get a massive discount.
And I don't think those buyers and operators are going to be able, long-term surviving this business. I mean, that's just I had a meeting. We got one under contract yesterday, and that was one. It's the first time with the broker, even though we've known each other for a while, and he knows that we're closers just like you guys. And that was one of the questions. He said, how often have you retraded a deal? I said, technically never. I said, the one time we did is we inspected it, and there was 25 more vacancies than he told us. I think that deserves a retrade, because that
constitutes.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a flat out, like, transparency thing. But I said, as long as it meets expectations of what we're told, like, never. Like, our goal is not to try to do that. And he said he's seen more retrades in the last month than he has in his entire career. Now, he's been doing it for 7 years, so it's not like 20 years, but he said, I've seen more retrades because people are trying to do that exact tactic. Like, hey, I'll get it under contract and let me see if I can get that guy from 60 to maybe like 45 through this retrade process. And I think it's, that's ultimately, you're going to lose a lot of faith with that broker and anybody who hears that story.
Oh, they've got a blazing trail behind them. But here's the part of that, which I'm going to say more or less sucks for me and you, is that they put it under contract for $60,000. We're talking about the same property. They put it under contract for $60,000. And then on the 11th hour, they retrade at $40,000. So our offer is what they actually closed with.
Yeah.
That's the part that is like, we gave you a fair offer out of the gates. We would have closed with that. They went with the higher offer. They got retraded on, and they still closed at the same amount that we would have. And this deal doesn't exist, but this is a hypothetical. This is
that's when you're banging your head against the wall, right? But I think you got to stand on, doing the right thing. And
just principles. Ethics and principles.
Hopefully that broker, if he brings another deal that has similar attributes that we just went through, that he knows, like, you're the right type of buyer. And, we've lost some deals because of that. I'm sure you have. Like, that's not the tactic we try to go off of. We try to give a fair win-win scenario for both parties, and hopefully we win the business.
Yeah, I've been retraded on as well. And the way it feels, truly retraded on at the 11th hour. And the way it feels is something I would never want to put a seller through, because it's exciting to sell a property of size. Mm-hmm. And then you're kind of waiting for the closing table. You're excited. And then the buyers come at the 11th hour and then trade. And then ultimately it's, all right, if I don't accept it, they're not going to close. If I accept it, you're taking a huge, it could be a significant loss. Well, not, it cut off the price. So it's just, it's something that it's just going through the motions of being retraded on. It definitely, it keeps your ethics intact, because again, what comes around goes around.
And as a seller, like, we're coming up on Christmas, right? So as a seller, it's like your kids coming down to see the Christmas trees underneath the present, and someone lit down a fire with gasoline. Like, it doesn't, like, like, you're so excited for that moment where that wire, and you signed that contract and literally it went up in flames. So even though that deal was probably a very profitable deal for you and your investors, it has a sour taste in it. So yeah, you're right.
Yep. No, it's, but just stick with our principles, keep doing what we're doing. And, you know, ultimately it's just, if the deal doesn't work on our, and the sellers take something else, it's a win for them. They go through it, then, you know, we'll keep doing what we're doing. We'll get there eventually. So as far as the market, you're confident, as far as, well, say the market and the debt that you all are using, that'll stay stood up for next year in order to keep buying, or how do you feel like the banks are going to fare with you all next year?
Well, I think most people are throwing stuff against the wall when it comes to guessing what it's going to do. But I think we hit the height, in my opinion, again, just one person's opinion. I think we hit the height when we were paying 7.75 or in that range not that long ago, and some quotes. And now we're starting to dwindle down. Do I think interest rates in 2024 are going to be 4? Or even 4.5? No. Would I hope in 2 years they get back in the 5s, 5.5? Yeah. You know, that's what we're underwriting at, is in 2, 2.5 years, 3 years, we can hopefully get back in the 5s. But I think what will hopefully happen is that we'll slowly start to creep down as far as interest rates, but sellers' expectations will also start to go down. And I think that gap where before interest rates went really high and seller expectations were really high, I'm hoping that it kind of reverses, where interest rates start to creep down, but all they've heard is how bad the debt environment is. And so expectations start to go down a little bit. I think there'll be deals to be had for the ones who stay active. They will get these opportunities that you were talking about before. Yep. And I do think that we will see a rebound in transactions, of course, in 2024 versus the record lows that we saw in 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Blackstone, well, they're reporting that they're sitting on almost $200 billion worth of deployable cash. That's, but they buy deals that we'll never even see. It's all, I mean, from institution to institution, but they're definitely, they stand ready for the grab. That's, next year. And then the inventory that, I was looking at yesterday on a report that came out from Newmark, the inventory is supposed to spike massively at the middle of next year and then taper off massively from 2025, January 25, and beyond. So,
yeah, I saw today that we're at a record, yesterday it came out that we're at a record high as far as ratio from income to mortgage payment or housing. It's at an all-time high. I think it was like 41 or 42%. Of someone's income is going towards their housing, which is significantly up from what it used to be even in the last 10 years. Like, we were in the 20s at one point in time based on the chart. So I think the other opportunity going in 2024 is that affordable housing. I don't mean truly affordable housing, like subsidized housing. I just mean actually someone can afford to live there. And I do think, you know, built to rent essentially is going to become a pretty big factor too, where you can produce housing at a fair rate for somebody to live in, because I think, you know, just single family homes have gone out of control as well. So yeah. I think there's going to be some categories where people lean into trying to ensure that, you know, Americans have affordable place to live. And I think those properties are going to stay full.
Yeah. There was a bill introduced to Congress that would essentially stop institutions from buying single family houses.
I saw that. I didn't read it, but I just saw the headline last night. So if you have any more information about it, I don't. I just saw the headline, though.
Yeah, me and you, there is nothing to really dig into. There was a headline. So what comes of that, I'm interested to see. But I think in order to protect first-time homebuyers, that something has to be done on that front. Because when you see Invitation Homes buying $400 million worth of single-family houses, those are off the market forever.
Yeah,
they're just never coming back, because they'll get traded from institution to institution. If they become too old of an asset, another institution comes and buys them for $800 million. the portfolio. But I think that in order to protect communities, first-time home buyers, the people that want to be a homeowner at some point, there's got to be something that's introduced. It's on the single-family home front, on multifamily apartment complexes, of course, that's you're in a totally different property class. But we can talk forever about real estate.
I know, me and you actually have a lot of similarities and backgrounds. So when you say we have some synergy here on the same mindset, so. Yeah, sorry to the listeners if we're going a little long and babbling.
No, I appreciate it. Definitely appreciate it. But I definitely want to have the listeners, if they want to get a hold of you and reach out, possibly invest, see how you're doing things, how can they get a hold of you?
So I always joke that I am awful on social media. Anything outside of a basic Facebook account, I'm really not on. But I am very active on LinkedIn. So me personally, if you want to get a hold of me or just kind of follow what we do and share data and mindset stuff, like absolutely LinkedIn, I'd love to connect there. The business-wise is just our website, followthedeal.com. You'll see anything that we're bringing to market as far as investment opportunities for our network and of course, kind of what we're doing as a whole. So that's exactly how me and Josh connected. So I appreciate the invite. I'm hoping to get a chance to talk to you again soon. Keep doing what you're doing. I think it's important for people to learn in these type of platforms.
I appreciate it, Ross. Definitely look forward to following you, and we will certainly talk soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.